Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, we have something of a property clinic. Perhaps you want to move home, you need to find a buyer, but in some parts of the country, they are few and far between. So if you don't want your home to be sat on the shelf, but you do want to make the most possible money, well, we'll let you know what you can do. Also today, more woes for diesel drivers and why Paddington Bear has been causing sore heads all round at the Royal Mint. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, if you're looking to buy somewhere, you may be surprised to hear we are in a subdued property market. Now, it might not feel very subdued with average prices going up on average £3,000 last month, we were hearing, but what a surprise, it depends on where you buy. The previously red-hot London property market and commuter belt suffering something of a reversal of fortune. Homes there now taking longer to sell and seeing prices cut. Now, the opposite is true of previously slower areas like the Midlands, the North and major regional cities where higher demand is pushing up prices there. So if you are in one of the areas where buyers are scant, what can you do to edge ahead of the competition and not just sell your home but get the best possible price for it? So we will get to that very shortly. But first, a little touch on my favourite subject, Simon. House prices and a subdued property market. So what do we mean when we're talking about a subdued property market? Because as I said there, if you take a look at some of the figures, 3,000 in a month seems quite a big increase.
It does. If I was going to give people one piece of advice when trying to navigate their way through the house price figures maze, it would be do not pay any attention to monthly house price figures. Yeah. We report them because they are in the reports. However, the most important number in there is what is happening over the course of the past year. Mm-hmm. And also, some of them allow you to see what is happening over the course of the last 3 months. So if you look at the Halifax Index, for example, which had that £3,000 monthly bounce, that's based on Halifax's mortgage approvals. Now, it's probably reasonably easy, even though that is a very large data set, for that to be skewed by just a couple of things in any given month. If you look at the annual rate of inflation there, that's 1.9%. That's pretty low. That's actually less than wages are going up by. Unfortunately, owing to the law of large numbers, 1.9% on the price of a house means that the actual price of the house is going up by considerably more than anybody's wages. But also then, if you look at the ONS figures that we had yesterday, which use land registry data, they are a couple of months behind the Halifax. They came in with a 3.9% annual return, which is higher. But what's interesting about the ONS numbers is that that figure has been below 5% for pretty much most of the last 2 years. That's still a reasonable rise in house prices, if you think about it. If inflation was 3.9%, there'd be calls on the Bank of England to start dramatically raising interest rates to try and curtail inflation. We seem to be a lot more tolerant of house price inflation than we are normal inflation, which I guess makes sense if you've got a house and you think it's going up in value. But it doesn't make sense on the basis that if you were to sell that house, chances are you'd probably want to buy another one, which would be getting more expensive. And if you were a first-time buyer, then house prices are getting away from you. But the overall picture is house prices are more subdued. Some of that is being pulled down by London and the commuter belt, which is suffering after a number of years when it went bananas. And the regions are doing better. But even in those regional cities, it's not like house prices are raging ahead.
I mean, Rachel, there's a load in there. I instantly think, and we haven't mentioned the B word for a while, but when we talk about house prices, wasn't George Osborne that said that they may drop 18%? I grant you, we haven't Brexited yet. But estate agents are saying a lack of properties on their books is one of the reasons it's propping up prices in certain areas. And I'm wondering if this is the famous housing shortage that we talk about more generally, or perhaps the Brexit effect, people perhaps holding off until they can get a better price, or is something else at work? Simon mentioned wages there.
So the things that are keeping it afloat are, as you say, people aren't moving very much. So estate agents have fewer properties on their books for people to choose from. And so that keeps prices up. Also, wage growth is kind of okay and people are in employment. So that keeps everything fairly buoyant as well.
But what's the reason people aren't moving as much?
Well, one reason is it's just so expensive. Forget that buying is expensive. Once you sort of factor in stamp duty and any kind of modifications you want to make to the home, and then fees, it ends up being pretty expensive, and that can end up being prohibitive for many people. But I think that, as you say, these are the reasons for a buoyant housing market, as economists might say, and as the experts often say in our articles. But I think that you're right, that the other thing to consider here is sentiment. To a certain extent, things are okay because everyone thinks that they're okay. And if there were a change in mood, then people might start to question whether this £1 million three-bed terraced house in London is really worth £1 million, etc. And then the other thing that could factor into that is changes to buy-to-let. If people start to realise, landlords start to realise that actually it's not so much in their interest to hold on to properties because of all of the extra costs now associated with it, then that will be a influx of property into the market that we haven't seen for some time, and that could have implications. You would have expected it to have start to happen by now, and we've seen some small signs. But once people start doing their tax returns, showing that they are not making as much, or indeed struggle to remortgage because they're not getting the kinds of returns that are now required, that may also have an impact.
Talking about the regional picture as well, a lot of places in London are seeing a fall in prices. But then is that just to get some sort of normality to it? Because while they say there's increase in prices in the north, I was strolling through the streets of Manchester the other day, seeing signs outside building sites saying one-bedroom flats starting at £119,000. And these were canal-side flats, which you wouldn't find that in London.
No, but there's something going on there where people are not entirely enamoured with buying new properties. However, new properties do tend to be priced at a premium, and you get the Help to Buy element going on there. I think one of the really big problems with the housing market at the moment, something that Rachel reflected on there, is that it is expensive to move. And one of the reasons why it's so expensive to move, estate agents' fees, yes, they eat a substantial amount of your property, but that's been cut back quite a bit by the rise of the online or the hybrid agents, the Purple Bricks, the Yopa, the House Simples of this world. So you could sell for less now. Mm-hmm. Solicitor's fees, gosh, anybody who's ever moved home will know how painful those feel, but they're roughly what they've been. The real problem is stamp duty. Mm. Now, stamp duty has been reformed, and it has been made cheaper lower down the ladder. First-time buyers have got a tax break. But I think the problem with stamp duty and the way it's been imposed over the years is a fundamental misunderstanding of economics and the economics of how a chain can work. We raised stamp duty through the 2000s property boom. Gordon Brown was a big fan of this. He started stamp duty when he took over was a flat 1%. And then he started introducing extra bans. Because the property market was raging ahead, people were very much speculatively buying homes. They were seeing the value of their home go up by lots. There was lots of buy-to-letters. There was a colossal global credit boom going on that made mortgages incredibly easy to get. They stopped checking whether you could pay back your interest only. They started bragging about how many multiples of your salary that they would lend you. They didn't check up on whether you were actually earning the money they said you were earning. That sort of masked the fact that stamp duty was a problem. So Mr. Brown, and then Mr. Osborne after him, thought that they could just keep tapping this and that stamp duty wasn't an issue. Now all those things have washed away. All of a sudden you realise that if you charge the people at the top of the market a whacking great big chunk of money as stamp duty, they just stop moving. It does affect the people buying the £4 million houses, but we're talking about the people buying the like £900 million pound houses. And unfortunately, in large areas of London and the South East, houses cost £900,000 a million now, and that's going to set you back £30,000 or £40,000 worth of stamp duty. So what happens is people go, well, I am only paying that much tax to move house once in my life. Mm. And so they've stopped moving speculatively. So the scenario where someone might have gone, well, this flat's getting a bit small for us, why don't we move round the corner to a three-bedroom Victorian terraced house? And then maybe in a few years after that, maybe we'll move to the detached house. Maybe then we'll move out of London. They just go, right, I'm not doing that. If we move now, forever house, because we're not paying £40,000 to the tax man twice. And the effect that that has further down is if the people there aren't moving, then they're not selling their homes to the people further down the ladder, who aren't selling their homes to the people further down the ladder. And you just end up with this scenario where you have a shortage of properties on the market. So then when people think about moving, they go, well, there's not even any point moving because there's hardly any homes for sale. And then you have a scenario where people are thinking, well, I'm not going to get as much for my house as I need because the gap between the two rungs of the ladder is so big. And you just end up with this logjam that we've got going on at the moment.
Yes, Simon, absolutely. But isn't the problem with this politics? It's going to be politically a hard sell for anyone to say, well, let's make it easier for those who are slightly richer or bigger houses to move and not pay huge amounts of tax. But also, and I don't want to go too off topic, but I know you do a lot of work, Rachel, with making economics a bit more understandable to people. Isn't there a problem with, I suppose, when you get politics or policy involved, it's very short term. It's all about, you know, what quick wins you can get. And I suppose for the government, this is a quick win, a bit of stamp duty. But we need something that can think about the longer term, the intangibles, the things that Simon's just spoken about. Will we ever get to that sort of stage?
Probably not, no. Because what government is going to mess with the housing market? What it does to the sort of collective sense of well-being, knowing that we're all sitting on several trillion pounds worth of imagined money. The Bank of England has done studies into what kind of impact that has on our spending. It's very profitable. People like that idea. You start messing with that, the value of people's homes, it gets pretty problematic.
But the government have been messing so much. Isn't that what's causing so much of the problem?
Because what government is going to let that one sink? It's worth too much to us as a country and to any political party to let that go. And so to keep it going, it seems like sometimes the only thing to do is just throw money at it, which I agree, long term, is not going to work. However, I think that sometimes it can work having grown-up conversations as a country about what we need and how we need to spend and what we value. Sometimes it can really cripple a party. See dementia tax, where a party tried to have a grown-up conversation about how we're going to pay for social care. But then in other situations, there's a lot of talk at the moment about adding a penny or two to national insurance that would be specifically ring-fenced for national health spending, or indeed a separate type of tax to pay for the NHS. People understand that there is a cost associated with the NHS and are willing to do it.
But perhaps, is that in itself such a sensible idea, or is it another kind of move to go, look, we need the money, so what can we do? This seems quite popular. Well, what happens if we fall short of that? Are we going to take the money from somewhere else? People don't really understand what they're paying the other set of money for in terms of income tax and all the like. Isn't there just so much complication going on? Sometimes doesn't the government just need to hold their hands up and say, actually, we're not going to interfere too much in this?
Maybe, but I think in the longer term, a lot of these things do need a bit of meddling. I mean, with an ageing population, we're going to have to spend more on the NHS and we're going to have to spend more on social care. And I think it pays to be a little bit upfront about that. And maybe there's a conversation to have about housing as well, to point out that one grandparent's house price growth is a grandchild's inability to get onto the housing ladder. And we have to think about this problem as a whole.
We go off topic a little bit. Simon, before we move on to what you can do to get your home in a good order if you do want to sell it, what are your thoughts on this? And I suppose, what are your expectations going forward?
Well, the problem with repeatedly pulling levers to do something, as has been done with the housing market, which actually started off with this stamp duty thing where Gordon Brown was like, oh, hang on a minute, there's some money to be had here. And it's actually, if you think about it, a particularly dumb tax because it inhibits movement. So people don't move for work or for family reasons. It introduces a transaction cost that means that people don't transact. So actually the tax itself, in a sense, decreases its own tax base because it puts people off moving. And also, it is a bit daft to just, instead of taxing people on their regular income, to just tax them randomly when they move home a large amount of money. That started, but then you've had Help to Buy, you've had all the first-time buyer initiatives, you've had all these other things. The problem is, though, is it's like cutting your own hair. You cut a bit off here, and you've got to cut a bit off here, and you've got to cut a bit off here. Oh, no. And then all of a sudden, you've got a haircut like mine. Not to say that that's all over the place. It's very short. But this is the problem with doing this kind of thing, is you have unintended consequences. And actually, the interesting thing about it now, and the property market at the moment, is that first-time buyers are doing all right. First-time buyer numbers are really quite good. Mm. If they can raise that deposit, which is either going to require some savings, bit of help from the bank of mum and dad, or even a 95% mortgage, see podcast past, then they can get on the housing ladder. But it's the next bit up, the second steppers or the people moving to their third home that's now the problem. Yeah. So, yeah, the tinkering is causing increasing problems throughout it.
I mean, so is it time to get rid of it altogether?
Well, I'd just take it back down to 1%, actually, to be perfectly honest, and explain to people that this is a bad tax and that we want to going to make up the tax revenue from elsewhere.
Right, Rachel?
You'll get it back on the VAT from carpet right and tops tiles soon enough. I mean, all of those sort of brands are really struggling. You get people moving again and everyone's buying carpets. That's going to be nice for the exchequer.
Which leads us nicely onto, if you think about selling your home, well, the key we hear, isn't this right? We spoke about this a couple of weeks ago. If you're going to sell your home and you price it realistically, especially according to the area in which you're moving. So take a look. And this is where I do grant you, as much as I hate house prices, it might be quite useful to know what's going on in your area. But what about before you put it on to market? Now, you have a reader's question, which I imagine you probably get quite a lot. And it, not just for readers. Down the pub is a question that you get asked a fair amount. I'm thinking of selling my house, says the reader. I'm not. But it needs quite a bit of work. How much should I do before I put it onto the market? And do you think that I should focus on replacing the kitchen and bathroom first? Which leads us nicely into what is it that people, I suppose, are looking for when they go and buy a property. And Rachel, I think you bought relatively recently, so it's still fresh in your mind. Wasn't it just all about the price?
Yeah, it was, but that's not what estate agents tell us. They say that people like to walk into a potential property and visualise themselves in it. You're selling them a sort of aspirational dream of what life might be like. Remove personal items like photographs of family so that instead of seeing it as your home, they might imagine their family on the mantelpiece. And so then things like bathrooms and kitchens, if you are not putting them in for yourself and your own tastes, but more to be able to sell, then the advice is always to keep things as plain as possible. But whether it's worth doing that in the first place is highly questionable, because the chances are someone will come in and want to rip it out anyway. And you can do an awful lot with a lick of paint and fixing the mouldy grouting and a bit of lighting, a few candles, maybe bake some bread. A lot cheaper than putting in a new bathroom suite.
Well, that's a really interesting point, Simon, that Rachel's just raised there. How much of it is due to what estate agents tell us we should do? And how much of it is actually really useful? I mean, do you need to rip out your whole kitchen and get a new one for 10 grand or just bake a bit of bread? Not in my case, because I will probably burn it.
I would be very wary of any estate agent that tells you you need to rip out your kitchen and put in a new one. And I've never encountered an estate agent who's ever suggested that. They would normally actually tell you not to do it. But what they would tell you is what Rachel said, is if you think your kitchen's so bad your house isn't going to sell, then replace it with something neutral. Don't replace it with something with bright red gloss doors, because not everybody likes bright red gloss doors, however much you do. If you're going to sell your home, you need to make your home look as good as it possibly can. This is a fundamental concept. Probably 40% of people selling their home seem to be incapable of grasping. Maybe it's laziness, maybe it's inertia, maybe it's the estate agent giving them bad advice. But you need to make your home look good. Firstly, you need to know what the housing market is doing, and you need to know what it's doing near you. So if the housing market near you is going really well, you're going to be able to sell a property pretty easily. And you probably can get away with spending less money in making it look good than you would otherwise need to. Fast forward to now, London areas, flats are sitting on the market for months on end and not selling. You need to probably put some more effort into showcasing it, and maybe spend a little bit more money. So you need to know where the balance lies. So for example, at the moment, Bristol's housing market is going great guns. Mm-hmm. Manchester's housing market is going great guns. You could get away with putting a bit less effort in there. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't put any effort in at all. Why would you do that? Because you're competing against all of the other properties in that area. They are also selling into the same market that is going great guns. So you want yours to look better.
Is it just about getting it sold, or is it also about you could command a higher price or a bit of both?
Okay, so you want two things. The best price that you possibly can, and you want to get it sold. And how quickly you want to get it sold is up to you. It might be that you want to sell it straight away, move very quickly. It might be that you're willing to wait around a month or so, 2 months, to try to get the best price. It might be that you've anchored on a certain price and you are willing to sit there until you get that price. The first one is much easier to achieve because you just price it right. And if the price is right, you will sell your home. The second one is a bit harder because you're trying to get a better amount and it requires a bit on luck. And that's where really showcasing it comes in. The third one is a real gamble because things can move against you. And actually, estate agents will tell you that the best offers tend to come early in the process. It gets less likely that you're going to get a really good offer if your house has been sat on the market for a while. So you need to showcase it to the people coming in. But before you do that, the most important thing to do is showcase it to the people to get them through the door. And how do you get people through the door nowadays? People go onto Rightmove and Zoopla and they look for properties there.
Go online.
You need to make sure that those photos look as good as they possibly can. Don't overly flatter your home so that the buyer comes around and gets disappointed that that lounge that looked the size of a banqueting hall on the internet is actually a teeny tiny little snug. But make sure it's clean, tidy. People do not like pictures of hallways with bicycles in. You wouldn't believe the amount of times you do it. Pictures of the outside of the house where there's a whacking great vehicle just parked in front of the house so that you can't see it. Blurry pictures, wonky pictures, pictures of gardens that are full of rubbish. You see these things all the time. How long would it take you to just clear the rubbish out of the garden and cut the grass? So it's simple stuff. Then it's, do you need to paint? Okay, so the easiest thing you can do is paint a house. Painting a house will make it look fresher if you do.
Inside or outside?
No, the inside. Right. Neutral colours. Go white, something like that. You might be able to just get away with cleaning it up. Carpets. Spending the money on a new carpet. People often move in and buy a new carpet.
Get steamer.
If your carpet is really, really bad, maybe you do. And then things like bathrooms and kitchens, probably not worth replacing. Probably easier for you to just be willing to accept the cost of a bathroom or kitchen off the price. And then it's your decision as to whether you take that off the whole asking price or whether when you go halfway to make it more attractive and when someone comes around and go, I know it needs a new kitchen. I took that into account on the asking price, but I tell you what, I'll give you another £4,000 off to help you get the kitchen.
Does seem an extraordinary large waste of money when you think about, you know, kitchens can be 10, 15 grand, how much it costs to replace a bathroom for a place that you're going to leave anyway.
And that's why you shouldn't put in a new kitchen or a new bathroom.
And is that what you told the reader?
You should not, coming full circle. Do not spend pots of money on something like that to sell your house. If you genuinely think it will mean that you get an extra 10 grand and it will cost you a grand to do some decorating and do some tidying up, do that. Do some of it yourself. Just think of the things that you think let it down and then target them. Ask your friends and family when they come round to give you their honest opinion. If you are anchoring on a higher price and you need to convince yourself to cut the price to get it sold, think of all the things that's wrong with your house. If you are struggling to even break even, think about why you want to move. Sometimes you just have to cut your losses and get on with it. If you can get that bit of money in the middle to allow you to move, if you can't, then you might be stuck where you are. And then maybe you just need to go, right, that's okay. I'm going to make the most of living here. Just use your common sense. But the most important thing for showcasing your home is the thing that gets bandied around all the time. And I think people ignore it. It's like the old take your lunch to work thing to save money. Declutter.
Yeah, please
get rid
do.
Of some of the clutter.
It's
you rent yourself a storage
photos.
Unit for 20 quid a week and take the stuff to the storage unit and put it there until you have sold your home. You'll actually walk around your house and you'll have a weight lifted off your shoulders. Yourself, you'll think, actually, I quite like this place.
Maybe I'll
stay
want to
here.
Move. Yeah, exactly. Do you know, all of this reminds me, it was good advice to get someone external in. It reminds me of the advertising sell for Febreze. And when they were trying to sell this product, the creators, they've got this amazing, you know, new chemical that can actually get rid of the smell, not just mask it. They kept going round to homes and people with dogs and really smelly places, hockey kits and the like. And these people were saying, no, I don't want to buy it. Because they didn't realise that their home smelt. So how they changed the advertising was saying, trying to make it just the next step in your cleaning programme so that everyone could do it. But yeah, if you'd have gone round to that house and said, by the way, it smells and it's a dump. I mean, you may lose a few friends that way, but honestly, it's a good way to sell your home and to make it smell nice.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now, if you're one of those people who just cannot wait for the latest commemorative or special coin to come out from the Royal Mint, well, you might not have to, especially if you live near the Mint in South Wales. Because it seems, in a case of life imitating art, like the stowaway bear from Peru, a 50p coin with Paddington on it has somehow found its way into the change of a student who went to a shop in nearby Caerphilly. The problem is, it's not meant to be released until, well, later this month. And the Scroogers at Royal Mint are demanding that Paddington comes home. Cue stories about crazy prices on eBay. Where is Lee Boyce, the coin man, when you need him? Rachel, though, step into the breach and tell us a bit more about Paddington. Why is Paddington going to be gracing coins?
So this is a great story from Lee. Two coins due to be released sometime later this month, we think. And one is of Paddington, I think, waving a flag outside Buckingham Palace, and the other is at Paddington Station. And they are to commemorate the books that came out 60 years ago and were requested by the Queen. While they were supposed to have been released later this month, strangely, one has appeared on eBay. And it turned out it was found by a student in her change from a local corner shop very near the Royal Mint, which is in Wales. And she found it and realised it might be worth something, put it on eBay. There was certainly a bidding war going on, which is where I think the boy spotted it. The Royal Mint were not happy with this because they're not supposed to be out yet. And we're not supposed to even know what these coins look like. So they apparently got in touch with the woman and said, "We'd like it back, please." And
she's, so it is genuine?
It sounds like it is indeed genuine, yes. And she said, no. And,
understandable.
And, yes.
And, as you put on eBay for many
and
thousands.
It was making a fair bit of money. And so then apparently Royal Mint made her an offer, which she declined. Nothing in writing, but we are told that she was offered a grand.
Oh, goodness.
To match an outright bid that was made to her. But then that was subsequently, I think, withdrawn. So the rest of us all have to wait until later this month for the Paddington coins. And in the meantime, someone on eBay may have just bought one for several grand.
I think the figure went up to about 15,000 or something for this coin. Why are the Royal Mint so keen to get it back when, look, we just have to wait about a week and we can all have one?
Well, because it's not meant to have been released yet, and it's managed to somehow sneak itself out of the building.
Which therein goes...
in a Paddington-style escape.
And
we
why
are not entirely sure. There is a suggestion that I can't go into as to how it may have made its way out. It's not suggested that it was nefarious in any way.
Well, no, somehow, otherwise it wouldn't end up in a shop in Caerphilly. It would be on eBay.
As part of promotional work that was going on in there, somehow someone managed to end up with one and take it out. And they obviously weren't trying to steal it and keep it for themselves and sell it on eBay, because it then ends up in a shop.
Makes you think, if you bought a bag of crisps for that 50p, how gutted would you
be
right now?
I mean, it's not quite Bitcoin Pizza Man, the man who bought a pizza with a Bitcoin. It's on its way. The great thing about this is it's a cracking yarn. Because actually, this came about because we revealed that this 50p coin was for sale on eBay. And then the girl's dad got in touch with us and said,
anyway,
and told us the story about the whole
exclusive thing.
So yeah, it was our exclusive story. But I mean, Lee uncovered the 50p originally for sale on eBay. We covered the story, and then they got in touch with us and said, well, actually, that's not even the half of the story. So it is a cracking yarn. The bit that the Royal Mint tried to get it back, apparently by offering a free tour at one point.
No and way. Lee wouldn't have done that, though, to be fair.
Then rescinded the offer to buy it. It is brilliant. It just goes to show this sort of craze for coins that people have. And I guess the really interesting thing is there's not really any way of proving, presumably, that this is the first coin. It's not like the old £5 notes with the serial numbers on them, where each one's got a different one. Your coin doesn't have any particular marker on it. So in a few weeks' time, anybody could claim that the Paddington 50p they've got is this one that managed to sneak its way out the Royal Mint first.
Point.
It's fascinating.
One thing I want to know, though, as well, and as a bit of a side note, is I know a little bit about coins, not a lot, granted, but if I got one of these in my change, I'm not sure I would have gone, whoa, has Paddington Bear been released yet? Can I put it on eBay and get loads of money for it? Because I wouldn't know what's coming out next.
No, I'd forgotten, actually,
but
about
well
the Paddington Bear coin, though I do have an advantage in the fact that if I did find one in my change, I could just ask Lee.
That's true. That is true. You could do. All right, well, we'll move on for this because, goodness, a bit more trouble for diesel drivers. And I'm wondering, Simon, is there a bit of a personal issue with our next story? Because car and van drivers across a huge swathe of London, it was announced this week, will face daily charges of £12.50 under a new ultra-low emission zone expansion. Now, that's to come in, I believe, by 2021, but no discounts for those who live in the new area. And again, it's harshest for those who are diesel drivers. So, Simon, are you, in your council that you love so much, covered?
Yeah, I live within this zone. Me and a lot of other people. So, if you do a little bit of history on London and its congestion and emissions charging, you've got the central congestion zone, which basically encompasses central London. Broadly speaking, the bit within the Circle Line, although it doesn't go as far out west as the Circle Line does. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it goes quite as far east either. And there's a couple of main routes through it. That was introduced, dramatically cut car use in the centre of town. But the problem that we've had is successive governments have encouraged people to buy diesel cars, telling them that they were better for the environment. And then it turned out that they were worse for our health. So now there's a push to get them off the road. London's air quality can be very bad. It is not universally bad. In fact, in some places, it is fine. It is what you would expect in a big city. After all, we are not in rural Cornwall. However, something does need to be done about it. So what we have being introduced is something called the ULEZ, the Ultra Low Emissions Zone. The original plan for that was to cover the congestion zone, where there's now this thing called the T-charge that's come in. And the idea is that basically you charge high emissions vehicles, vehicles that don't meet a certain standard. And there are two standards that are required. For petrol cars, it's something called Euro 4, and that is any petrol car first sold before 2005. For diesel cars, it's a more recent standard. It's the most recent one, Euro 6, which came into place in September 2015. Now, if you want to drive your car into central London and it does not meet either of those standards, you will be charged £12.50 a day. Pretty expensive, but seems fair enough. Central London has some residents still living there who aren't super wealthy, but is broadly speaking a residential area dominated by the wealthy, and also a business area and public transport and things like that.
Something, wouldn't you?
Now, Sadiq Khan raised this idea a while back after he's elected that he wanted to extend the ULEZ all the way out to the North and South Circular. Now, that dramatically changes the game, because the North, if you go out to the North and South Circular, you are suddenly encompassing a huge swathe of residential London. They had a consultation on it. They have finally announced that they are going to do it. But on that bombshell, to borrow a Top Gear phrase, he dropped another bombshell, and that is that there will be no discount for residents living in that area. It's not just people driving in to that area. It is anybody within that area who has a car that doesn't meet those standards. If they drive their car at any time of any day, on any day of the year, so not Monday to Friday, not just during the working day, any day of the year, any time, they will have to pay £12.50. That is a seriously big step. Now, you might argue that it will dramatically reduce car use, and it probably will. My argument would be that it creates all kinds of weird, warped scenarios, and that also it's using a sledgehammer to crack a nut.
Which is back to the thing we were talking about right at the start. One thing gets a bit of money, and you think it's doing something, but what impact will it have elsewhere?
Yeah, so look, firstly, this is deeply regressive. It costs poor people more than rich people. So there's one way to avoid this. You don't have a car. So fine, let's put that to one side for a moment, okay? If you do have a car and you feel that you need to use a car, and actually there's lots of reasons why people living within the North and South Circular own a car and feel that they need to have a car and use a car. They might need it to go visit their family. Even simple things like going to the DIY shop and back. They might need to drive their kids to breakfast club for 8 o'clock in the morning so that they can get to work on time. That's something that me and my wife have to do. But they can either trade up to a newer car that won't be affected by this. However, the people who are most likely to be able to trade up to a newer car are richer people.
Who can afford it?
Or they might not want to trade up to a newer car because they might have a car that they don't really use very much. It might be a trusted old car, but they only do a couple of thousand miles a year in it. Whereas the person who has a brand new company BMW that they don't even pay for, the company pays for, they might be doing 15,000 miles a year in it. They might have a classic car. I've got a classic car. I'm clearly not going to trade up to a newer car rather than a classic car. So the situation would be every time that car moves, it would cost me £12.50. Now, I find that slightly unfair, and also I find it slightly warped that someone who drives a five-year-old Ford Focus diesel would be charged £12.50 a day or forced to buy a new car, which will then depreciate by thousands of pounds, when someone driving around in a brand new Bentley Bentayga 2.4 tonne, 6-litre, £160,000 SUV won't pay a penny. Neither will the person driving around in the Range Rover, the brand new Porsche Cayenne. In fact, if you bought a Lamborghini, you could drive your Lamborghini around as much as you wanted and you'd never pay the £12.50 because the Lamborghini is new enough to meet the emission standards. However, if you've still got a trusty old 20-year-old Volkswagen Polo that you've been noodling around in and you don't really want to spend money on a car, well, that's tough luck for you. I think that in the whole principle of don't bring me problems, bring me solutions.
Yeah.
I would argue there's a better way of doing this. £12.50 all the time, every day, every night in the central zone if you want to. In the outer zone, you could make it with a residence discount to £5 and you only do it during the daytime, during the week, Monday to Friday. And I bet you that that would hugely decrease car usage anyway, because £5 is enough of a deterrent to not just jump in your car and use it if you don't need to. And I think that we should have gone one step first before going nuclear, which is what has happened here.
Rachel, any views? Something needs to get done. Surely no sympathy for those gas-guzzling drivers and the like, and that money could be put to better use on public transport and all that sort of good stuff.
It does seem to be very, as Simon says, a very dramatic sledgehammer move, but something has to be done. And there was a study out that the cost to the NHS of health damage from cars and vans across the UK is £6 billion a year to the NHS, and in London is £650 million. We don't get all worked up about it because you can't really see it and you can't draw an easy, tangible correlation between cars and people's health, but it's definitely there. So I think something has to be done. I'm not sure if it is the right way and if there would be a way to make it more progressive. It gets more complicated trying to work out how to make sure that those least able to pay the least. But I think there's room for more thought around it. And I just hope that any money that is brought in from this tax goes straight towards the transport system or subsidising transport for people who can least afford it.
I think also one of the reasons why I think this is such a bad move is because it affects ordinary families. It doesn't have this residence thing. But also because we have a history of ill thought out measures to do with motoring and housing, as we were talking earlier. And that I think we need to think a little bit more about some of these things before we leap in. So, for example, why are all these diesel cars on the road? Why does this problem even exist in the first place? It's because the government decided in the early 2000s that petrol cars were bad and diesel cars were good, and then did everything they possibly could through the tax
system
to encourage people to buy diesel cars.
So they do have to have a
exactly.
bit of a
U-turn. So, but it's the unintended consequence. Also, it's worth pointing out the sources of NOx, nitrogen oxide. This is the bad thing that we're talking about in Greater London. 50% of it comes from road transport. The other stuff comes from other things. Of that, diesel cars make up 12% of the total, of the whole 100% total. Petrol cars make up 6%. But then the rest of that is caused by vans and minibuses deliver as much as petrol cars. Transport for London buses deliver slightly less than diesel cars. Rigid HGVs, non-transport for London buses and coaches. In fact, if you put together transport for London buses and non-transport for London buses and coaches, they're more than diesel cars. Taxis, Arctic HGVs. And one of the things that is driving up emissions from cars should theoretically be going down due to the natural cycle of replacement of cars. But the emissions are going up from vans due to the Amazon effect. All these vans buzzing around the place, stopping, starting, delivering parcels. And if you look at the statistics as well, from the non-road transport stuff, you'll find domestic gas produces as much NOx as diesel cars. And then all these other things. And then we hear these stories about wood burners and stuff like that. And I think the real problem here is there is a paucity of information for people to understand what's going on here. Try to ascertain what is going on, what we can do about it. Mm. And you end up with scenarios where if the owner of the classic car that drives a couple of thousand miles a year gets charged £12.50 every time it moves, but the owner of the Bentley Bentayga drives around doing whatever they want, you get knee-jerk reactions from people who go, this is just stupid, I don't agree with this, rather than thinking, actually, maybe I do need to change my behaviour and I do need to do some things about air quality. And the reason why this matters to all of those people who are listening to this who think, well, I don't live in London, I go there on the train occasionally, is that where London leads, the rest of Britain's towns and cities will follow. That. And that is the government policy, is instead of the government doing something about this, they are kicking the can down the road and trying to encourage local authorities to do it.
And I absolutely agree with you in terms of the communication thing. Wouldn't it be lovely to have had leaflets to suggest that this is the reason why we promoted it in the past, this is why we now are clamping down, perhaps a slower increase in money, and then it would make you feel like you're just being hammered to fill the TfL or London coffers. If it was a slower introduction of it, you might have time to kind of save to buy a new, cleaner car, because I'm sure a lot of people, when you explain it, will want to do stuff for the environment, will want to create a better place for their kids, but also a bit of information about domestic pollution that we have. What can we do as individuals to try not to have such an impact on the environment? But there you go. I'll step off my soapbox and thank you both very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk, or you can download the app. And if you like our podcast, please do rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.